is Central Standard. I'm Alana Gordon. And today, we're going to hear from local poets and musicians about their new work and what inspires them. Les Ismore and D-Well are out with a new album and opening for a pretty big act coming to town next week. But first, married poets Janet and Stanley Banks came to our studio earlier this month and sat down with Central Standard producer Matthew Long Middleton. The local poets each have new works out. Here's Matthew with Stanley and Janet Banks.
Thank you both so much for joining us.
Yeah, our pleasure.
No problem. We
Thank
love
you.
It.
So I kind of just want to jump into it a little bit, but like, how did you two meet?
This was in 1994. I have all the dates nailed down. 1994, a friend of mine at the time, and I didn't know that this friend was a mutual friend of ours. He invited me to a reading that he was putting on down at Hallmark, and it happened to be Stanley. He said his name is Stanley Banks. He's a poet, and he is a teacher at Passaic High School. And we went down there. I saw him. I dug him right off
Lucky
the bat.
Man. Lucky man.
I dug him. And I never told
I'll
my friend.
I get that a lot.
I never told my friend that I liked him. And so 2.5 years later, I was talking to this very same friend. And I was telling him, you know, there are no guys out here, you know. He said, why don't you and Stan hook up? I said, okay. I said, why don't you do that?
Now, so, yeah. This friend, his name is Myron Davis. He was the editor of Mahogany Card Line. Mm-hmm. And I did a series of freelance cards for them. I did about 8. I mean, where it's really great. They circulate about 30,000 copies. Mm-hmm. Of your card, they put your work on the card, and then they put your bio on the back. I mean, that's great advertising. Plus, as a professional writer, you know, thank you, Hallmark. They pay better than anybody, right? So we became friends, and I didn't know of Janet, and he started, you know, he was telling me about her. You know, I didn't like blind dates, right? People have put me on blind dates before, so yeah. I said, okay, and we had a conversation, you know, when we first talked the first time, and we talked for hours.
6 hours, to be exact.
So we decided to meet and, you know, just kept, you know, just seemed like, you know, we just had all kind of things that we related to. You know, I write about my grandmother. My grandmother is my muse. And Janet, her mother is, you know, was very important in her life. And she'll probably talk about that too, but those similarities were really striking, right? But it's like she said she knew me 2.5 years before, and I was like, wow, that's incredible because, you know, I was getting to the point where, you know, I was getting frustrated too with the dating scene. And we just kind of continued on. Now, that was one story. The other story, the other part of the story, should I say, I was doing workshops for the Nelson Atkins Museum. I've done those over the years. And, you know, as a date one night, she said, I'll come to the workshop with you. I said, okay. So she comes to the workshop, and I've got about 10 students, you know, where they go in and look at the art, and then they write about it after a few minutes. So, you know, great art there. And so I opened it up, and I said, okay, you guys have seen the art. You know, who's written something? And nobody raised their hand, right? And Janet raised her, and I was like, oh, gosh, I can't have my girlfriend take it up all the time here. You know, people are looking at us real crazy or something.
And that's a slight conflict of interest.
Oh, yeah, you know. And, you know, that hot streak that goes down the back of your neck. I'm like, oh, gosh, if this is terrible, I'm really in trouble, right? She read her poetry, and the whole group just loved it. And I said, you've never written before? And it just started like that.
Yeah. And Janet, you were working for Hallmark Cards.
Yeah.
And so were you writing when you were there? Is that what you were
doing?
Actually,
I wasn't. I was not in the creative field. All my work was all on the analytical side. And we dealt with, like, artists, and we dealt with, like, all different departments, you know, at Hallmark. Because what we did, well, basically what we did was we were pooper scoopers.
Go on.
We cleaned up people's messes. We cleaned up people's messes.
So you worked in the creative field, but you wouldn't necessarily call yourself, like, it wasn't a part of your livelihood at that time.
No.
And, I mean, were you doing other kind of, like, did you write on the side? Or, was this first time when you were at the Nelson Atkins?
It was the first time when I was at the Nelson Atkins because when Stanley talks about his grandmother, my mother was a closet poet. She...
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. What do you mean by that? I've heard you say that before in some of our previous broadcasts.
Yes.
Like, closet poet, what does that mean?
Meaning that she wrote, but she didn't share it. You know, it's like, as a poet, you know, I think that's a gift that is given. It's a God-given gift, and I think that it is to be shared. She never shared it. She did get a chance to share it. I mean, she's no longer here with us. But before she passed on, she got to share her work. And that was the most excited I've ever seen her as, you know, somebody that got to get up there in front of people and read her work. And, you know, it was just as exciting for me because she's the one that planted that seed to begin with. He nurtured it, but she planted it.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, when you say closet, like, she wrote, but she didn't really share all that much. Like, did you have this moment when you discovered some of her old works and writings?
Oh, yeah.
And was she alive when? Is she still alive?
She showed them to us. And she always kept, like, a spiral notebook beside her bed with a pen because she said that she would get up in the middle of the night. She wouldn't turn the lights on, and she'd be scribbling. And she'd get up in the mornings and look at the scribble on her tablet, and she would have to try to make out what she wrote in the dark. But
were they very dreamlike? Was her poetry very dreamlike?
Her poetry was, some of it was dreamlike. Some of it was tinged more on relationships and spirituality and
folksy,
very folksy.
Did you get to read any of it, Stanley?
Yeah, actually, she had a couple of full handwritten books. Because I didn't think any of it was typed up, was it?
No.
So, and just, you know, it's like a lot of people, there are a lot of artists who never really think they should share their work with anyone, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's when they say closet writers, gifted, until somebody says, why don't you share it with the world?
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. Our guests are Janet and Stanley Banks, both poets. We're discussing their creative life together and some of their work. I kind of want to get to this a little bit because, you know, I think that there's such a narrative of, like, of African-American families being broken.
Right.
But in the works that I've read from you guys, family pervades a large part of both your poetry.
Huge.
So can perhaps maybe you can each share a poem from your works that, you know, is about family, and then address that issue of, like, the idea of the broken African-American family.
Sure. Did you want to go first?
No, you go ahead.
That's interesting. I've talked about this for a long time, and I come from a family that's really had some hard struggles, right? And I mean, from you know, murders and...
Who was murdered in your family?
My father was murdered. And my brother was murdered first at 17, and my father was murdered 6 months later. I grew up, I saw my aunt shot. She lived, but I saw her shot and saw the shotgun blaster across the street.
That sounds like an incredible amount of trauma in your life.
Yeah, it can be. And I tell you, with friends, you know, with a lot of prayer, therapy, just kind of, I tell you, writing helped that process as well.
You writing even then?
Yeah, I was. Now, when my aunt got shot, I wasn't. But when my father was murdered and my brother was murdered first, but then my father, I was definitely writing. And their spirit shows up a lot. I've got poems about them, a lot of poems about them. And, for example, this poem, You know, one thing that you always, I'm always writing about the ideal of family. And this is one of those, I used to stay at a house on Indiana. It's called Ghost After 27 Years in the book. And it's just some going back, you know, writers, we like to go back in our minds and try to piece together some things and some notions. Because I don't, you know, I'm one of these kind of people. I don't see, when I hear, it seems like the voices of family members or I feel them around, that does not frighten me. You know, it's like, okay, you're coming back to comfort me. My grandmother taught me that, right? So this is one of those poems about those ghosts, the ideal of ghosts. So no hope of the ghost in my house staying gone. When it's quiet, they sleep too. But when danger is near, nonstop activity in the walls, light fixtures, and appliances, creaks and cracks. My dreams take me back to 10th and Vine Street. My brother runs the base pads with terror in his eyes. My father half steps along the avenue, getting farther and farther away. The back of my grandmother's head is silvery gray as earthworms slither down her neck. Beloved ghosts know how to speak in a nonverbal, non-frightening manner, warning that real horror comes on live feet. And so, you know, I write about my grandmother, my father, my brother. And, you know, you as writers, as artists, you're always trying to figure out where does the chaos come from? Why is the insanity? And I've had people say, you know, Stan, you write a lot about murder and death. But when you read the poems, I hope I'm not just focusing, they don't just focus on the drama and the horror of it. But I always try to, there's still life after death. You know, they're, what will you do now? You know, what are the spirits telling you to do? That's where I'm looking at whenever I talk about somebody, you know, the death of my father, my brother. If you read some of the poems, they end in either musical ways or some kind of humorous way, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's what they would have wanted. You know, people will tell you that, hey, you know, if something happens to me, you know, you got to live your life. So it's that kind of, I hope at the end people go, ooh, that was tragic. But hey, keeping on, as they say.
When you close this poem with, but the real horrors come on the live feet. Yeah. You know, like, it sounds to me like you're kind of insinuating the hard part is living, you know.
No. What I'm saying is, it's like the ghost idea, right? Uh-huh. People are afraid of ghosts, and I'm like, if there's real horror, right? It's the folks who are living, right? The ghosts are there. My grandmother used to. I've got poems about her where she talks about the cracking and creaking in the walls as a reference to that. And every time that would happen, my grandmother, I think she knew voodoo or something. You know, she was just that kind of person. But scary stuff, you know, the cracks, the bump, the thump in the night. She was, oh, don't worry about that. That's just Uncle So-and-so coming back. That's just my dad coming. And as a kid, I'm like, huh, really?
Well, it's so interesting, you know, that's the way she frames, like, the narrative, mm-hmm. that the narrative isn't about, like, it's this otherworldly thing. It's actually you're being surrounded by love.
Yes.
Right.
The spirits of love rather than evil spirits.
That's exactly it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, so, you know, the ghosts come back, and she told me that the ghosts come back to warn you or save you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And so I took that to heart, and I, you know, it's like, it's just my little kind of twist on the whole idea of scary ghosts, right? And, you know, so it's just these poems always try to go back and, you know, capture some moments and, you know, just recreate a feeling sometime.
And Janet, could you share a poem, you know, about your family?
Sure. My family was very close-knit family, still is. Both my parents are no longer here. But I did grow up with both my parents in the home. My father was a World War II veteran. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. So she was there as we were growing up. And there was a poem that I had written about being at this home that I grew up in. And, you know, as you're coming of age, you feel like you need to go out and, you know, find out what the world is all about. But once you get there, then, you know, you don't realize how good you have it. Mm-hmm. And so this is
what's the name of this?
It's called Sugar Mountain.
Sugar Mountain.
For Mama and Daddy. Without a care in the world, a little black chocolate-faced girl with huge eyes dancing and shaking by herself, in her own space back then, an independent soul, was sheltered and spared from the world out there. Deep inside was an adventurous nature, with her mama by her side, who had a spiritual voice that put the fear of God in her, keeping her humble and showing her who's boss when she had an attitude. Her mother fought to make her a decent woman. Her father demonstrated stability, protecting her from teenage pregnancy, dope, and alcohol. She thought they were both out to ruin her life, but the real world was a shock to her system. Now, at night, she sleeps well, remembering how she had it made on Sugar Mountain.
The meter there is so nice.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, and I mean, why did you choose to write this almost a little bit in the third person?
I chose to write this in the third person because it was me, but it wasn't me. It was me looking down at myself, you know, looking down at the person that I was becoming. Because what was happening as I was growing up, I was moving farther and farther away from that structure that was put there for me. But then once I got out there in the world, and I did get out there. But, you know, I've learned that you don't stray away from what you got taught from your parents. And so you do tend to move not necessarily back to this place because you can't go back home again. But you can move back to the center
and or the ideals of
the ideals of it and understand why they were doing what they were doing. Because like, as I stated in the poem, I thought they were trying to ruin my life, but they were trying to make me a better woman.
Yeah. What were you trying to make your life when you were younger?
It's just trying to find myself. But then I found myself in these certain circumstances.
Could you elaborate what those were if you feel comfortable?
Yeah. I found myself in some relationships with men that didn't pan out. And
were they abusive?
Verbally, usury. It was more verbally.
Mm-hmm.
It was more verbal than physical. You know, and I find that verbal abuse is a lot worse to me than physical. Physical scars go away.
Mm-hmm.
Verbal abuse is more emotional.
And you can internalize it.
And you can definitely internalize it. Yes.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to get on this for just a moment. You both wrote, you know, about your mothers or your grandmothers, these very powerful, prominent, and sounds like, you know, for the most part, really positive influences in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk a little bit about male figures and like how you both decided to depict men in your work and your relationships with your fathers? Or,
well, you know, I write about my father who. Was a very abusive man.
And we're talking both physically.
Yes,
and
physically and verbally. He was an alcoholic. And the strange thing about him.
Was that hard with your mom being a bootlegger?
Like, well, my grandmother was
a bootlegger. Oh, excuse me. Your grandmother was the bootlegger.
And he was her son, right? So it was like night and day. My grandmother had three sons. My father was one of them. And her whole attitude was totally about, you know, work hard, do whatever you got to do your hustle, take care of your family, right? And my father was a bit of a dreamer. And he's not unlike a lot of fathers. It's like I've talked about my father. I think I've shared him with so many people who have exactly the same kind of father. The kind of guy who's a dreamer, very bright. He's dropped out of school because he wanted to make money, had nothing, no quote skill, but he was a jack of all trades, right? And, you know, when things got tense, on Friday and Saturday, that was the difficult times. But from Sunday to Thursday, he was like Ward Cleaver, right, because he's making up. So Sunday to Thursday, he's, oh, come on in, kids. You know, good to see you. And he's talking. I talk more with him at home than I did with my mother. But after, you know, a few years of that, of, you know, it's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of thing. You know, around about the third grade, yes, I said, mm-hmm. I decided to just move with my grandmother permanently, just to get away from the physical abuse.
That's such an adult decision to make at third grade. I mean, like,
yeah. I ran away in the first grade, actually, and finally made the move in the third.
But I mean, I can't even, from my life, I can't even imagine having to make such a powerful decision. I mean, like, you know, I think it's something that everybody struggles with, you know, like, when do I break away from my parents? How much do I break away?
Yeah.
You know, do I live in another town? Do I live in another state? How much relationship do I want to have with them?
Right.
And for a variety of reasons, but I mean, like, in the third grade, that must have been incredibly difficult.
It was made easier because my grandmother and my father, they all lived on the same block, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in some regard, that was easier to do because I could just, as the saying goes, run down to grandmother's house. To grandmother's house we go, right? And in the first grade, I was the oldest son, and that's the only son at the time. And basically, I was just a scary little kid, right? So, and he'd always come after me, you know, be a man. I'm like, okay. You know, so one night I just jumped, you know. We had these windows. Now, you know, people have thought I'm so heroic. We had these windows that were low to the ground. I jumped out the window, went to my grandmother's house. First time, the scene was this. I go to the door and I knock on the door. And it's, I don't know, late night something. My father's come home and he's rampaging.
What season is it?
It's the summertime.
It's summertime.
And I'm knocking on the door and then the door is opened by a woman who I didn't know. And it's kind of dark inside the house. I'm like, they said, who are you, baby? And I said, I'm a Georgia Banks' grandson. He said, oh, come on in. It was a house full of women who were like they were hiding, which they were. It was Friday night, you know, that time when the males were rampaging and beating up their women. My grandmother was harboring those women.
All these people of domestic abuse, essentially.
Yes, they came to her house because everybody, my grandmother being that old bootlegger, I'm not saying anything, you know, the statute of limitation is over, I think. but they all knew Georgia Banks. So, you know, they were in the house trembling, scared, and their husbands or boyfriends would come by one and say, Georgia, send my woman out, right? And my grandmother would go to her front, her second story porch and tell them, now go home, so-and-so, you know, sleep it off, and they go home. Now, the only ones that didn't go home.
She sounds like such a powerful, strong woman.
She knew some, you know, those, again, the statute of limitation is she knew some of those guys. You know that movie Casino? They talk about the Kansas City gangsters.
I haven't seen
it. Or De Niro, those Kansas City gangsters. They were like my uncles. She grew up with those guys, right? The meat market guys. You give a good piece of meat every now and then, you know. Always gave me a lot of candy. But my grandmother, the bootlegging business was so interesting. From 7th Street to, now, you know, we have 18th and Vine. That's what my bugaboo thing. In the real day of bootlegging in Vine Street, it was like about 7th Street and really 12th Street, it stopped. That was the Mecca right there. And, you know, then you had down by the river area, right? So my grandmother knew all these guys, and yeah, I guess she had a reputation, right? But the only people that would even dare to talk back to her was my father and my uncle. Then after a while, she, you know, threatened to, as she said, throw a few pistol balls at them. And then they went home. But, you know, that it was like on Friday nights for a while, me and the hovering other women in her house till finally I just decided just to, you know, I'd get my pillow and pack my stuff. Because I had my sisters at home, all my play buddies at home. And so I'd go back and forth, but I'd stay with my grandmother. So it's like her whole, literally.
Do you think that was a decision that maybe, you know, like, was life-altering? Do you think it was a super, you know, like, a very important moment?
Most definitely, among many. Mm-hmm. You know, when you grow up, there are a lot of those, you know, I've been so blessed to have my grandmother, who a lot of people say, well, she was a bootlegger. Yeah, but she, you know, she sold beer and sandwiches, right, when I came along. I don't know about the other stuff, right? But she sold beer and sandwiches, gave people, you know, food when they didn't have food, you know, policemen, religious folks, politicians came by and got food.
She should have run for office.
Yeah, you know, that's probably who held, you know, it was the Pendergast era,
yeah.
Right? And she was around during that era, and bootlegged all the way up to the 60s. So, you know, just powerful. She was one of those powerful kind of women that at her stage in life, like she has seen it all, done it all, and along comes this grandchild who was weird, goofy, scary, and for some reason she saw something in me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so she was going to protect that.
And Janet, I want to get back to you. We kind of got a little off track about, like, you know, how you represent male figures and how you think, like, that representation, you know, like, because, you know, I feel like there are a lot of different images of male, black male,
mm-hmm.
you know, masculinity sure. in our culture.
Right.
And so do you have a poem that might demonstrate that or?
Well, I just wanted to talk more about my dad.
Yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
know.
Speak of your father.
The thing about my father, and he is the one that gave me and many members of my family gave me the work ethic that I had and still have. And he also gave me stability. My father, I said, was a World War II veteran. When he came back from the war, he was living in Oklahoma at the time, and he hadn't met my mother. And when he did finally come up here, meet my mother, they got married, and, you know, started having children, he was working at a chemical plant called Thompson and Hayward way back in the day. And when he and my mother had me, he was, 40 years old? And that was considered old back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
That was in 1960. And my father, he was working at this chemical plant, and he was also a smoker, which the two just did not mesh. And his doctor told him that with this smoking, working at a chemical plant is going to kill him. And so he quit. He started looking for jobs. But of course,
or he quit the chemical plant, but stuck with the cigarettes,
mm-hmm. you know, which is what eventually, you know, was, you know, the thing that killed him.
Yeah.
And so in the meantime, after he quit the chemical plant, he was looking for jobs. And looking for jobs in 1960 for a black man was rough. Nobody would hire him, one, because he was black, two, because of his age. He was 40 years old.
And we're here in Kansas City.
And right here in Kansas City, it was 1960.
Oh, 60, excuse me. And Martin Luther King, the riots were 68. So mm-hmm. that hasn't even happened
that
yet.
That hadn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was trying to find jobs. My father was very good at painting. He was very good at painting houses inside and out. He was very good at doing little odd jobs, electrical work, little jobs as brickwork, stonework. He was really good at all that. And he realized that after going through all that he had gone through, trying to find a job, knowing he wasn't going to get hired anywhere, he decided to create his own job. And he would go and he would paint houses. Back then, they didn't have business cards. His work that people would see was his calling card. That's what he did. And that was his, you know, occupation. He was a house painter. And he was very proud, you know, of what he did. Very proud of his handiwork. And it was, you know, that was the most wonderful times growing up, seeing him come home in his overalls or coveralls covered with paint and his face blotched with paint. And we were so happy to see him, you know. And, you know, it's not that we were rich, because we weren't by any stretch, you know, because you can only make so much, you know, from that occupation.
And he was the sole provider for your home.
He was the sole provider for our home. You know, my mother, she worked prior to them getting married and having children. But since, you know, she had us, he thought that it would be better for her to stay home and raise us. So, you know, I got that work ethic and that stability, you know, that staying power. You know, it was this man, this strong man, this, you know, this strong male role model. And, you know, as it's stated that your father is the person that will be, that will set the stage for your relationships to come. Of course, it is true, but on the other hand, it's not, because you can have a father that comes home every night and still get into a relationship that's dysfunctional, because it happened to me. Mm-hmm. But I got out of it, thank God, and I met Stanley.
Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Have a great time.
Appreciate it.
That was Central Standard producer Matthew Long Middleton with poets Stanley and Janet Banks. They read from their newest works, Blue Issues and On the Edge of Urban. I'm Alana Gordon, your host of Central Standard today. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, local hip-hop artist Less Is More will be in studio to discuss his new project and the art of hip-hop. Central Standard returns in just a moment.